break a leg.
As your second speaker here this evening, my name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. And I am from Hagerstown, Maryland. I am a member of the third oldest AA group in Maryland, the cleverly named Hagerstown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. When our group was established, we didn't know this thing was going to catch on and there was going to be resentments and coffee pots and meetings all over. I do want to thank the committee for inviting me to be here with you this evening, and to thank you for the basket that you so graciously provided in my room, full of things that I'm not supposed to eat, which I have eaten. So you got a problem here? You need a little more, like, can't hear me, huh? Okay. Kenny threw the thing off. It was fine a minute ago. I also want to thank the committee for allowing, I'm not too sure who this should be directed to, because I heard Sleazy was introduced as the guy who was responsible for getting speakers. You ladies in the sixth, fifth rows here in the center, watch out. There's a 13-step dance, and Sleazy's changed his appearance. But I was going to thank Mary Jane for inviting me. But then I think it's important that you know who invited me, because if I say something that offends you in the next 2.5 hours that we're together, I think Sally should really take the responsibility for that, and she's easier to find. As we were beginning this meeting and introducing the people who are here who have served Alcoholics Anonymous in capacities far beyond the group level, I would like to add my thanks to those that have already been expressed, to those of you who are trustees or past trustees or delegates or past delegates. I thank you for your prodigious service to Alcoholics Anonymous. We stand on the shoulders of giants here, and if it were not for people like you, I would not be here today, and I thank you so much for your service. Least we forget those folks who are employed at the general headquarters in New York, Adrian. Last night, I hope you were here to hear Adrian's lead, and she was describing the General Service Office. Well, Kenny and I were over here on the right. I don't know if any of you else had a problem hearing. I couldn't tell whether she said repository or suppository. That Kenny was having trouble with that. So if you were here earlier today, you have already heard the best speakers you're going to hear today, in Keith, who, besides a wonderful story of hope and encouragement, also has served as a past delegate. And his wife, Kathy, who has proven without fail that you don't have to drink to be crazy. I'm going to put my watch up here, not because I can see it or pay much attention to it, but I think it gives hope to the newcomer, and I'm put it there. If you're here this evening and you do have a cell phone, please by all means turn it on. if you're expecting a liver transplant. But if you're not, put it on vibrate, and that way you can enjoy your incoming call and you won't disturb the rest of us. I've been asked to share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I think it's important. I think you all know this, but in case somebody gets hold of a tape of this lead, that you know that I am not an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am not a spokesperson for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just a fellow who was a liar, a cheat, and a thief, a user, abuser of people, places, and things, and I allowed myself to be overserved from time to time, and that's why I'm here tonight. My dad was an alcoholic. It's important that you know that. Not that that's why I'm an alcoholic, but my dad was an alcoholic. He was married to my mom for 30 years before they divorced. My mom is 90. Well, she's going to be 91 years old next month. And I talked to my mom tonight before coming down from the room, and try to talk to her every day. And she said, "Oh yeah, that's right. You're out of town, son. Where are you anyway?" And I told her I was in Newport, Rhode Island. She says, "You're one of those AA things, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I am." She said, "I still don't understand why they invite you to those things, son, because I know you're not an alcoholic." And I want to listen to my mom. I'm somewhat confused on this subject myself, because had I known these things were going to be important, I would have really tried harder, but I have never been to prison. I've never been to jail. I've never been arrested. I've never had a DWI or driving while intoxicated or under the influence. I have never lost a job because of drinking. If I don't screw this thing up, my wife and I are going to be married 40 years come August. Although, well, that's applause for her, and you might want to give her a chip when this thing's over with. Because you're going to hear that she's been married for 40 years, and I've had momentary lapses of some duration. So I don't have any multiple marriages. I don't have any illegitimate children. I don't even have a good tattoo. And so you can see why my mom's confused. You can see why I'm confused. And you're probably wondering, what the heck did Sally do when she invited me here? She must be confused also. When I was 14 years old, before I had begun my drinking career, you notice we're the only ones that talk about our drinking careers. but before I began to drink, my sister and my mother were out, and my dad and I were at home, and he wanted me to do something that I didn't want to do. And finally we made a deal that I would, in fact, do this thing that he wanted me to do, and he would do what I wanted him to do, and the thing that I asked him to do was to stop drinking. And after a little reflection on that, he said that he would stop drinking. And I need to tell you that I was ecstatic, because I've been praying that my dad would stop drinking. I know my mom and my sister had been praying that my dad would stop drinking. And this was an answer to the prayer. I mean, our problems were over. I mean, this was great. And when my mom came home that night with my sister, I greeted him at the door, and I told him, "Dad and I have had a talk. And he's agreed to stop drinking." And joy reigned supreme in our house that night. And the next day he got drunk. And that's the day I closed the door on God. Because I didn't want to have anything to do with a God that would play that kind of hoax on a child like me. I didn't know why I was unworthy, but I certainly felt unworthy. It was certainly clear that my prayers were unworthy. And if I was ever going to amount to anything, anything at all in this life, then I was going to have to do it myself. Me. And I set out to do it. Now, it wasn't too long after that that I was introduced to beverage alcohol, and I think I know that it did for me probably what it did for you. It just changed everything. It allowed me to do things that I had no capacity to do when I was not drinking. I could talk to people, have social conversations. I could dance. I could talk to girls. I thought I could sing. I'd heard a lady from the podium a few months ago say that when she drank, that her boobs got big and her pimples fell off. Well, I had the pimple experience. I didn't have the boob experience. But really, it was the elixir of life. It was the answer to all of my problems. And I set out to drink as often as I could, as much as I could, whenever I could. And I'd like to think that alcohol did not have a negative impact on my life at that time, but I have to tell you in all honesty that I spent 5 years in high school. And I used to think it was because of a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, but I know now that alcohol had a lot to do with it. And so when I got out of high school and I was going to the community college, a friend of mine and I were planning a trip to California. We had 12 cases of beer in an overnight bag, and we were ready to go. And his father wouldn't let him go. So what's a guy to do? I quit my job. I had a pocket full of money. I got a car with 12 cases of beer. I got an overnight bag. All everybody, everything you need for a road trip, but no place to go. I wasn't going to drive to California by myself. But as some of you know, the state of Maryland has a little sliver of land right against the Atlantic Ocean. And we have a town there called, of all things, Ocean City. And so I went to Ocean City. And I spent a month there. In effect, I lived as a bum because I wasn't working. I stayed with friends who were working in hotels, and they kept me in the basement of the hotels. And I ate leftover restaurant food, and I had my 12 cases of beer to drink. And I had a pocket full of money to buy stuff to drink when that beer ran out. And I had a great month in Ocean City. And I'm a keen observer of the social scene. I really wanted to go to work in Ocean City, and I decided that I was going to do that the next summer. But I noticed that in Ocean City, if you drank like I drank and acted like I acted, it didn't matter if you were a bellhop or a beach boy or a lifeguard or a waiter or a waitress. It didn't matter. They would arrest you. But there was one group of people in Ocean City I noticed were not getting arrested, and they were the Ocean City police. So I became an Ocean City policeman. The first year that I was an Ocean City policeman, I had a boardwalk beat, and I wasn't there a week, and it became clear that I have a particularly good talent for a policeman in a resort community. I could spot an underage drinker from 100 yards. And when I would approach that underage drinker and establish that indeed they were underage, I'd ask if I could look in the cooler. And, of course, they would lift the lid of the cooler, and there across the top of the cooler laid out in nice rows was a Coca-Cola and a loaf of bread maybe and some tuna fish. But you know, I think as well as I do, that once I reached down in the bottom of that cooler, I'd come up with a Budweiser. And then the whole tone of the conversation would change. Because their life as they knew it was over. They're going to jail. They're not going to college. They're going to jail. You may think that you were going to go into the military, but once you get out of jail, they're not going to want you. We're going to call your parents at 3 a.m. in the morning to come down here and get you out of jail. Oh, you'd like to suggest an alternative? What did you have in mind? Confiscate the beer? I guess that's worthy of discussion, but if we confiscate the beer, we're going to have to take the cooler, and if we take the cooler, we're going to take the tuna fish and the bread. All right, but don't you ever, ever come back here again and do that. Well, if you're walking a beat on the boardwalk, it's hard to drag a cooler full of beer around behind you. So I had to work out a deal with my lieutenant and sergeant, and the deal was they'd come with their squad car and they'd take the coolers as I collected them. And at the end of the shift, if I had any whiskey or wine, they got it. And since I didn't drink whiskey or wine in those days, it seemed like a good deal. So I had a very good summer that summer. I didn't get arrested. I didn't buy anything to drink. And it seemed to be all right by me. So I went back to be a cop a second summer. And again, a very successful summer. Only this time they gave me a squad car. And you got a squad car, lights and sirens, I mean a real squad car, up and down a beach highway just spotting those underage drinkers. I mean, you pull up behind one of them and a car fills up with smoke immediately. So, I mean, you get up there and they're all in there smoking. So can't smell the beer, you know. So with a big car like that, you don't have to be calling your sergeant and lieutenant a whole lot because you got plenty of room in the trunk for many coolers that will go in there. But at the end of the shift, I had to meet my sergeant and my lieutenant in the parking lot, and we'd divvy it up, same deal. Another good summer. I didn't get arrested, didn't buy anything to drink, drank all summer. My definition of a good time. I went back for a third year. Now, I'm going to tell you about an event that occurred during the third year that really changed the course of my life, turned my life in a direction which I had not anticipated. It was 3 o'clock in the morning on the beach highway. I stopped a guy for drunk driving. The convertible had 3 or 4 people in it. This guy was obviously drunk. I'm writing up the ticket. He says something to me like, "You don't know who I am, do you?" And I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county you're standing in right now." Well, I was a college kid. I didn't know what a state's attorney was. Never even heard of a state's attorney. I said, "Good for you. Sign the ticket." And he signed the ticket. And there was a fellow in the car who seemed to be sober, so I let him drive. And I went about my work. When I pulled into the parking lot of the Ocean City Police Department at the end of my shift, there standing in the parking lot was the chief of police. And he said to me, he said, "Quarterman," he said, "come up to my office and bring that uniform citation book with you." Now, these were the first words the chief had spoken to me all summer. And I thought this was a good thing. I was going to get recognition, long overdue recognition, I might add, for a job well done. And so I went up to the chief's office, and as I walked into the door, there, seated on the couch right inside the door, is the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. And the chief says, "Give me that uniform citation book." So I handed it to him. He flips it open to the ticket. He hands it to the guy sitting on the sofa. That guy reaches into his coat, pulls out a pen, and writes across the face of that ticket, "Case dismissed." It was at that moment I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could become one of those state's attorneys, I definitely wanted to be one of them. Because the ability to dismiss traffic charges with a stroke of a pen, if you drank and drove like I drank and drove, that ability was going to come in really handy. So I went to law school. And when I got out of law school, my wife and I moved back to Hagerstown, which is where I grew up. And I hadn't been there but a couple of weeks. Then they were advertising for an assistant state's attorney. I went right over. I knocked on the door. "Here I am. I'm the answer to your prayer. Sign me up. When do I begin?" Now, what I'm about to share with you is what I think I heard them say. As some of you probably understand, that much of what I think happened in my life never really happened the way I think it happened. My sister tells me frequently the things that I thought happened in our home never happened. I just thought they happened. So this is what I think I heard them say. "What? You become kind of an idiot? You just got out of law school. You just passed the bar. You've never tried a case. You don't know anything. We don't have time to train you. You've never been in a courtroom. You've never addressed a jury. You've never examined a witness. Get out of the office." That's what I thought I heard him say. Upon reflection, in all truthfulness, I think they said, the position's been filled. But I heard what I thought I heard, and it upset me. It angered me. I now know that as a result of what I thought I heard him say, I have a resentment. Well, I don't know about here in Rhode Island, but in Maryland we elect our state's attorneys. So I went out and found a lawyer who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He got elected state's attorney, and he made me deputy state's attorney. I hadn't been in that office 30 seconds, and I noticed a serious deficiency. We had no badges. And there's no point in being a state's attorney if you can't have a badge. So I designed a beautiful badge, wonderful badge. And the most important thing about a badge is that when you get a badge case. And in the badge case, they got this clear glassine thing where you place where you put your driver's license. So when they pull you over and they say, let me see your driver's license, well, you open up your badge case. And there's the driver's license. They're not interested in that. There's the badge. They are interested in that. What kind of badge is that? Oh, the badge officer? Deputy State's Attorney, Washington County. That's okay, officer. I understand. Just doing your job. No. I only have a couple blocks to go. I appreciate the professional courtesy. Yes, you have a nice evening too. Yes, sir. Now, some of you may be getting some insight into why I don't have any arrests in my background. But it does get better than this. We're a small community, at least we were at that time, and we only had two circuit court judges, and one of our judges retired. And so my boss, the state's attorney, was going to be named judge by the governor. And this was going to be a good thing because that meant I would be state's attorney. Well, I don't know how it is in Rhode Island, but in our part of the world, sometimes a state senator sticks his nose in where it doesn't belong and screws the whole thing up. And that's what happened in this case. And somebody else got appointed judge. And I was very upset. Not because my friend didn't get to be judge. I mean, I was concerned about that. But I didn't get to be state's attorney. And I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. And I got together with some other like-minded people, and we were discussing over a few adult beverages the injustice of this whole thing. And it was determined that we should run somebody for state senator. And so I ran for state senator. Now, I did not know that the state senator was going to abandon his wife and children and run off with the secretary from the Appropriations Committee, but he did, and I got elected state senator. Now, in Maryland, if you get elected state senator, they give you a license plate, and it says on it, state senator. Now, the reason they do this is because it's an aid to efficient law enforcement. When they come up behind you on the interstate with those overheads on, and they get close enough to see that license plate, they turn those overheads off, they come up alongside, they turn that interior dome light on, and they toot the horn. Hi, Senator. Hi, Trooper. Hold it down, Senator. Okay, Trooper. And that way, you don't have the state police tied up along the shoulder of the highway when they could be out arresting real criminals. Right? Well, the guy who got that, I'd like to tell you about my time in Annapolis. I really would. That's our state capital, Annapolis. But maybe you have the same thing here, I don't know. But in our state capital, we have a group of people whose sole purpose in life is to make sure that every member of the House of Delegates or the Senate can get something to drink at any time of the day or night upon request. These people are called lobbyists. And I had a lot of lobbyist friends. So if I were to tell you anything about my time in Annapolis, whatever I would tell you would be nothing but rumor and hearsay. And I don't like to engage in that. So suffice it to say that while I was a state senator, the guy who got appointed to the circuit court that my boss didn't get the job, he didn't like being a judge and he resigned. So I went to the governor and I said, I'd like you to appoint my friend, the state's attorney, I'd like you to appoint him judge. And the governor said, we are very upset. We're still very upset about what happened several years ago. And we're not appointing your guy. But if you're interested in being circuit court judge, we'll appoint you. Well, it's a 15-year term and it only comes around every now and then, so okay. I became a circuit court judge. Now, let me say that I just loved drinking. I mean, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I like the appropriate drink in the appropriate glass. I think it's very important. I mean, those long, slim, frosted Tom Collins glasses, you know, the martini glass, the nice shapes, the chilled tankards. I mean, I loved everything about it. But if you were to thrust a brown paper bag towards me and say, take a pull on this, it's really good, I wouldn't ask you what was in there. I'd just drink it. Because you wouldn't offer it to me if it wasn't good. I know that. You know how you're cleaning up after a party at the house and there's cans around the house and stuff. I mean, you go, oh, this has got a little something in it. You know, poo! What was that? Cigarette butt. I noticed in the play this afternoon there's some cigarette butt drinkers around here. Yeah. Yeah. I thought so. My people. I loved everything about it. I loved top shelf. I loved bottom shelf. I wasn't too keen on things that had corks in them because that's twist off caps were more my speed. Now I'm a circuit court judge and I want to be helpful to the Bar Association in any way I can. And they were going to have a continuing legal education program on the prosecution and defense of drunk driving cases. And they needed a volunteer to blow into the breathalyzer. And they needed somebody who was impartial, unbiased, fair-minded, and willing to drink the beer. Okay. So, you got the picture. We're all set up, ready to go. They got a dais like this kind of, and Sergeant Long's over here with his breathalyzer, and the guy brings out a tray, and it's got six cans of beer in it all iced down. And I said, what's that? They said, it's the beer for tonight's program. I said, you do understand this is a two-hour program. He said, you don't have to worry. We got plenty in the back. I said, I'm not drinking any warm beer. I said, you got to ice some more down. So he brought another six out, and they started a program. And the deal was I would drink, and every 15 minutes I'd blow into the breathalyzer. So, you know, you get started, and you start a little low. You start like 0.05 and 0.08, and then maybe a little 0.11, and then 0.14, and then a 0.17, and then a 0.20, and then a 0.23, and then a 0.27, and then a 0.30, and then a 0.33. And then they called upon me to put on my part of the program, which I was told was pretty good under the circumstances. But program's over, and Sergeant Long's packing up his breathalyzer, and I said to the guy, chairman of the program, who's going to drive me home? He said, drive you home? I said, yeah, I just blew a .33 in the guy's breathalyzer. I can't get in the car and drive home. We never even thought about that. I said, well, all right. I said, well, I'm going to go into the bar and have a couple drinks. And when Sergeant Long's gone, you let me know. And so after a while, they came in the bar, and they told me he was gone. So I went down to the Broad Axe and I had a couple drinks down there. And then I drove over to the cellar door, and I had a couple drinks there. And then I went home. And that was just a night of social drinking by the judge. Now, on April the 7th of 1982, a lawyer and I were going out to have dinner. That was the stated reason. We were really going out to see how drunk we could get. I mean, you know, sometimes you get struck drunk and you don't mean to. But this night, we were going out to get drunk, and I mean drunk. So, and we were doing a good job of it, too, let me tell you. And we finished up a couple places, and we ended up in a local facility that was known to be populated by the best-looking, recently divorced, separated, and single women in our community. And we went in there to get a nightcap, and had I known, I think it's really important that you know this, had I known that this was going to be my last drink, I want to assure you that I would have ordered something else. I mean, I had a love affair with Jack Daniel's Black on crushed ice with a twist of lemon. That was to die for. That was wonderful. I was also very fond of the gin martini, although I had a very bad gin experience, and even to this day, it's hard for me to go into a pine forest. But this which I'm about to tell you, had I known this was going to become an issue, and I was going to be asked to come to Rhode Island and to share this embarrassing, I don't blame you for leaving. I'm embarrassed as it is. My last drink was Tia Maria. Nobody is more embarrassed than me. Not really. What a weenie drink. Man. I do have some assurance, however, that that drink came out of a tainted bottle. And the reason I think it did was because on the way home that night, I got sick to my stomach. Now, that is not part of my experience drinking. Oh, I got sick to my stomach while drinking, but you just go out behind the dumpster and throw up and go back in and continue drinking. That's part of it. I understand that. And I've gotten sick to my stomach on Saturday morning after Friday night. I mean, I understand that's part of it. But it was not part of my experience to get sick to my stomach while driving home, so I'm pretty sure it was a tainted bottle. Now, my wife is an elementary school teacher. And if you know anything about elementary school, you know that those little kids are just disease-infested. And elementary school teachers, they bring home every germ in the county. And the next morning when I got up out of bed, I had flu. Unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. She brought a flu bug home from school. I went to work. The next day was Good Friday, so I was home. I didn't have to go to work, so I was home. And I had that upset stomach that comes with flu, and, you know, it was very distressing, and on Saturday, I wasn't feeling much better, and I developed that lower tract distress that sometimes comes with flu, and I'm telling you, if you got that lower tract distress, and you got that upset stomach, it'll hone your decision-making down to a fine edge, because you don't know whether to kneel or sit, or sit or kneel, and, my wife will tell you that on that weekend, I at least one time I made the wrong decision. So I don't know, and I'm not going to dwell on that. So let's. Easter Sunday, I wasn't much better, and by Monday, I was very dehydrated from all that kneeling and sitting. And so they took me to the hospital, and my abdomen became distended. And they did an emergency laparotomy on me, and they opened me up, and they found my abdomen full of peritonitis, gangrene. And while they were in there trying to clean that up, My liver was enlarged and out of whack, and my pancreas was digesting itself, and my kidneys quit, and then my respiratory system quit, and things were not looking good for the home team. And I was in that hospital in intensive care for 3 weeks, and then I was sent to Johns Hopkins Hospital. Now, I was encouraged by going to Johns Hopkins Hospital because I knew people who had gone to Johns Hopkins and they had lived. And I knew people who had gone to the Washington County Hospital and they died. So I was encouraged. Now, they told my wife that they were sending me down there to die because they didn't know that there was anything that could be done for me, and my situation was just deteriorating. I would have found that very depressing if they had told me. So, in any event, I was down there for 2 weeks, and they did everything but hang me by my thumbs. Now, my respiratory system did recover, so I was breathing on my own. But my pancreas was still digesting itself, my liver was out of whack, and my kidneys weren't working. And they came in on May 13th. May 14th is my belly button birthday, and they came in on May 13th to tell me that that they didn't know what else to do. And I just asked them for a day of rest. I said, tomorrow's my birthday. Please, just give me a day of rest. And they said, we will. And so on the 14th of May, they didn't do anything. And 2 weeks later, on the 28th day of May, I was discharged from that hospital. My kidney function returned. My pancreas stopped digesting itself. And my liver started to recover. Now, when you have an undiagnosed illness, they want to have an obligatory discharge meeting with you, and they want to tell you what to do and what not to do. But if you have an undiagnosed illness, they don't know what to tell you. So they told me, don't get it again. It's likely to kill you. Now, I think it's better to survive an undiagnosed illness than to die of a known cause. That was my position then, and that's my position tonight. And as I was getting up to leave those doctors, this one guy said to me, he said, Judge, he said, we got one more question for you. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, do you drink? Drink? Well, sure. I mean, I'm a lawyer. Well, I was a lawyer. I'm a judge. I mean, when I was a lawyer, I had to drink with clients, had to drink with other lawyers, had to drink with judges. Now I'm a judge. I got to drink with other lawyers. I got to drink with judges. Of course I drink. How much do you drink? Not much. Why? Well, because alcohol really does a number on your kidneys, and your kidney functions return, and we really think you need to give your kidneys a rest. And same thing with your liver. I mean, your liver functions are coming around, but nothing knocks the heck out of your liver more than alcohol. And the same with your pancreas. I mean, your pancreas was digesting itself, and it's not doing that now. And you start drinking, alcohol is liable to set that thing in motion again. So we just think you should not drink for a while. How long? They said, a year. A year. Well, I hadn't had a drink since April the 7th, and this was May 28th. I guess I can do that. They said, no, Judge, you don't understand. This is Memorial Day weekend, and we want you to not drink from June the 1st. Now, I think there are people in this room who already see the injustice that these doctors were trying to foist upon me. I was getting no credit for my 7 weeks of sobriety. And I want you to know that I fought for those 7 weeks. And we ended up having a compromise. And the compromise was that I would not drink until April the 7th. And then, if I thought drinking had anything to do with the pain and suffering and misery that I had just undergone for the past 7 weeks, then I would not drink until June the 1st. And then, if I wanted to, I could drink. So I walked out of the Johns Hopkins Hospital not drinking. And I walked out of there not changing. And as our big book says, that when you take alcohol away from a guy like me, I become restless, irritable, and discontent. Actually, that is a gross understatement in my case. I embarked upon the most insidious, horrible part of my life that I'd ever experienced. Not drinking and not changing. I had no program, no Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody had said anything about my having a problem with alcohol. Not drinking, not changing. Two people that I knew who were friends of mine in Alcoholics Anonymous, Bob and Ken, watched me as I was dying of untreated alcoholism. Not drinking, not changing. Bob, who knew my dad, I should back up and tell you that on my dad, the alcoholic, after he lost that 30-year marriage to my mom, and after he lost his business that he'd worked so hard to build up, and after he lost his respect of my sister and myself, was walking by the Methodist church, and they had a sign outside that said, "Don't buy a fifth on the third for the fourth." And my dad went to Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and he never drank again. And for that, and that alone, I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I carry my dad's 15-year chip with me, along with my 23-year chip, in hopes that in some way he knows that I'm trying to give back to Alcoholics Anonymous, which was given to him, and then subsequently to me. But back when Ken and Bob came to see me, I wasn't hearing it. And they knew my dad had been in Alcoholics Anonymous and died with 15 years of sobriety. And Bob said to me, "Jack, wouldn't you be interested in learning something about your father's disease? We got this book called Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe you'd like to read it, find out something about it." Smart guy that, Bob. Because if he had said to me, "Jack, we think you ought to read this book to see what's wrong with you," I think you and I both know I wouldn't have touched that book with a 10-foot pole because there's nothing wrong with me. I'm not drinking. And everybody knows, I know everybody knows, that alcoholics drink. Therefore, not drinking, not alcoholic. All right? We got that? It's settled. Not drinking. Leave me alone. Mind your own business. Get away from me. All right? I'm fine. So I read that book, and I was not surprised to find that my father is in there. He's a real alcoholic, as defined. He was a real alcoholic, as defined by the big book. Obviously, he identified himself as an alcoholic. The thing that surprised me was that I'm in there. Yeah. You remember that thing I said about at the very beginning about closing the door on God? In that book, it says many of us at a very early age closed the door on God. And you see, I thought I was the only one. How could they know that about me? That book was written before I was born. How could they know that about me? I thought I was the only one. And in there it says something about Bob going into the bar and swearing he wasn't going to have anything to drink, and then pounding on the bar, whiskey rising to his head, saying, "How did this happen to me? Oh, what the heck? I might as well get loaded." Well, that was my experience. I mean, I used to go into the Bronx all the time. I'm only going to have one, no more than two. I'll be home by 6:30, no later than 7. I leave the place at 1 a.m. because that's when they closed, you know. And I'd like to say that only happened once or twice to me, but it didn't. It happened 4, 5, 6 times a week to me before I had that Johns Hopkins experience. How did they know about that? And then I read in there that, you know, the problem for the alcoholic isn't alcohol. The problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind. Well, I told Ken and Bob. I mean, after I read this thing, they started coming to my office every Friday. And they brought their big books and a brown bag lunch. And we, the three of us, we would read the big book. And they would explain to me the importance of what we had read. And I would explain to them what I knew we had read. And we'd had some interesting intellectual discussions, Ken and Bob and I. Now, you know that when they came to my office that they knew something that I didn't know. They knew, not only did they know something that I didn't know, they knew that I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And had I known that they knew something that I didn't know, and I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know, I'd have been angry about that. But they were very persistent and consistent in carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me, because they knew that what they knew that I didn't know, that when I did know it, I wouldn't be upset knowing that they knew that I didn't know what I didn't know I didn't know that they knew that I didn't know. Because here you know when you know that you know, and not a moment before. Now, if you followed any of that, you're in the right place. And if you didn't follow it, found it a little confusing, you're still in the right place. It just means you don't know. I'm being encouraged to attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, but you need to know that as a circuit court judge, Alcoholics Anonymous in my community experienced a tremendous spike in attendance. Because I know what to do with people like you. And I sent them to Alcoholics Anonymous. So we got this burgeoning population of alcoholics, and I'm not going to meetings with those people. But I will go up to Chambersburg, just up the road from Hagerstown, or over to Frederick, or down to Martinsburg, West Virginia. I'll go to a couple meetings and see how that works out. Now, what I know today is what I had back then was what I call cake mix recovery. And if you were to accompany me tonight and go to a local grocery store and we bought a box of Duncan Hines Red Velvet Cake Mix, trust me on this. On the back of that box, they got a 3-step program for the production of a red velvet cake. And I'm the kind of guy that I like to read the back of the box and look around for my cake. Just like I was reading that book, big book, and I was looking around for my recovery. You know, I know now that if I want red velvet cake, I got to open that box and I got to take action on that 3-step program to produce a red velvet cake. And I know now that if I want recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to do more than just read that book or the steps on the wall. I've got to take action in order to get recovery. December 22nd of 1989, Bob and Ken and I went out to lunch. It was a Friday before Christmas, and the courthouse was closed. After having lunch together, my wife and I were separated yet again. I should back up and tell you that when I was actively drinking, my wife and I were separated 3 times. And there were women involved. And when I stopped drinking, we were separated 3 times. And there were women involved. I think that's pretty clear evidence that drinking had nothing to do with those separations. But alcoholism had everything to do with those separations. Because I was not drinking and not changing. So I was separated at that time that we broke up that lunch. And I went back to my apartment. A mailman had brought a package, put it against the door. It was a Hickory Farm thing that had cheese log or a sausage in it. I thought this was really nice. Somebody sent the judge a sausage. Maybe I'll just have a little of it this afternoon. And I went in to take messages off my answering machine. At that time, I had a girlfriend. I had a backup girlfriend, and I had a girlfriend for special occasions. And my primary girlfriend had made plans for us. We had plans for Christmas. We had plans for New Year's. We had plans for the rest of the year. My backup girlfriend and my special girlfriend and my primary girlfriend all objected to my marriage, and my wife objected to my girlfriends, and I was handling the situation very well. If you're looking for a delusional thought, that's a delusional thought right there. I am trying to open this Hickory Farm cheese log package, and I'm taking the messages off the answering machine. I see where the thing is taped shut, and I got my car keys out, and I slit the cellophane tape, and I lift the lid of that box. Boom! And I was blown back against the wall, and a federal appellate judge, federal appellate judge in Alabama had been killed 10 days before that by a package bomb sent to his home. A lawyer in Savannah, Georgia had been killed 5 days before that by an explosive device sent to his office. And I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew that I had opened a bomb. There was a fire. I tried to put the fire out. I couldn't. I went out and pulled the fire alarm. My neighbor came with a fire extinguisher. I went back in to call 911, and when I went to press the buttons on the telephone, I became aware that part of my right hand had been blown away. And after placing that 911 call, I felt my trousers being pulled off of my hips, and I looked down and I was standing in a puddle of blood, and it was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger as I watched it. And my neighbor brought a towel, and I opened my trousers, and I didn't have the courage to visualize the wound. I just put the towel where I thought the wound was and put my back against the wall and slid down on the floor, and it was pretty clear to me that I was going to die there. And I was never going to see our children again or my wife, and I was just going to die there. And the only thing that I had learned in my attendance at those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Chambersburg and Frederick and Martinsburg was I had learned the Serenity Prayer. And so I reached for the only tool I had. I prayed the Serenity Prayer, and I prayed the Serenity Prayer, and I prayed the Serenity Prayer. And I can't tell you whether it was the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth time through that prayer, but I can tell you that it was answered. And God came. And I experienced a sense of peace and serenity, the likes of which I've never experienced before, nor have experienced since. I didn't know if I was going to live or die on that floor, but what I knew without question was that it was going to be all right. It would be all right. If I died on that floor that day, 3 days before Christmas, it would be all right. The firemen, the emergency medical people, the police all rushed in. Both my eardrums had been blown out. I couldn't really hear what they were saying. I stopped praying to talk to them. As soon as I stopped praying, a wave of fear swept upon me. I told them, you guys do what you got to do. I'm going back to doing what I was doing. I went back to praying the Serenity Prayer, and serenity returned. And they cut all my clothes off of me except for my red and green Christmas socks, and they strapped me to a gurney, and they carried me down 3 flights of stairs, and they stuffed me into an ambulance. And we have a little TV station there in Hagerstown, and they were all Johnny on the spot, so they got the picture of my red and green Christmas socks going into the ambulance, and my socks went around the world on CNN that night. And they couldn't find my wife, and they couldn't find my girlfriend, but they found my sponsor, Ken, and he came to the hospital where I was being prepared for surgery, and he came back to where I was being kept, and he came and he held my hand, and he prayed with me, and they sent me up to surgery, and I don't know how shrapnel knows how to stop passing through flesh. All I can tell you is they removed a piece of shrapnel that was not resting against but in very close proximity to my femoral artery. And I think we all know that if my femoral artery had been nicked, you'd have a different speaker here tonight. And they sewed me up and they put my hand back together and they sent me up to a recovery room. And second day I was in the recovery room, my sponsor Bob was sitting at the foot of my bed and he had a big smile on his face. And I said, Bob, I see you're smiling. You want to tell me what you're smiling about? And he said, well, nothing much, Jack. He said, I just think it must be wonderful. I should interject here. It's really good to have a sponsor because they have a different take on things. I mean, they really do. They see things differently. And so I said to Bob, wonderful, Bob. I said, I'm not following. He said, well, I think it must be wonderful, Jack, to know that you cannot be harmed. I said, cannot be harmed, Bob? Somebody just tried to kill me. Oh, he said, I know, Jack. He said, I understand that package that you opened contained 4 pipe bombs. And he says, 1 pipe bomb is more than adequate to kill a human being. 2 pipe bombs is kind of duplicitous. 3 pipe bombs is really around the bend. He said, four pipe bombs? You really made somebody very angry. He said, I think man has done the very best he can do to kill you, and your survival is only by the grace of God. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that in a million years. He said, God has work for you, Jack. I said, really? What kind of work does God have for me, Bob? He said, well, I don't know, Jack. He said, I don't know what God's will for you is in that regard. He says, but I do know this, that it's God's will for you that you be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means you're going to have to pray that third step prayer with either Ken or I. You're going to have to do that four step inventory. You're going to have to do the fifth step with either me or with Ken. You're going to have to do the sixth and pray the seventh step prayer. You're going to have to make the eighth step list. You're going to have to make those nine steps amends so you can live in 10, 11, and 12. It's good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that one either. So I get out of the hospital and begin taking action on these steps. And I've told you I've got this thing about God. A little angry at God, a little hostile. Bob knows that. Didn't know my dad. Knew he had 15 years of sobriety. He asked me to explain why I was so angry at God. I explained to him exactly what I explained to you when I began this lead. And he said, how old were you, Jack, when you prayed that your dad would stop drinking? I said, I was 14 years old. He said, how old were you when your dad stopped drinking? I said, I was 26 years old. He said, 12 years. He said, do you know what 12 years means to infinite God, Jack? Good to have a sponsor. Never really considered that. No, Bob, I know. 12 years, Jack, it's a nanosecond to God. It's an infinitesimal period of time. He said, in point of fact, Jack, you got pretty quick service. I'm wondering, what's your problem? Well, my problem is in my mind. My problem is my thinking. Simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. Simply how I think is my problem. Among the really fine literature we have from General Services, we have a pamphlet that says, is AA for you? And inside of here, with some modification, there are a couple of questions I'd like to share with you. Have you ever decided to stop thinking for a week or so, but only lasted for a couple of days? Do you wish people would mind their own business about your thinking and stop telling you what to do? Do you envy people who can think without getting into trouble? Have you had problems connected with thinking during the past year? Has your thinking caused trouble at home? Do you tell yourself that you can stop thinking anytime you want to, even though you keep thinking when you don't mean to? Have you missed days of work or school because of your thinking? Have you ever felt your life would be better if you just did not think? Yeah. In our big book, there's something called the Nine Bedevilments, and Bob was going over these with me. You know, we're having trouble with personal relationships. And I did mention the girlfriend, the backup girlfriend, and the girlfriend on the side. Couldn't control my emotional natures. I was a very, very angry alcoholic. Prey to misery, prey to depression. Couldn't make a living. Well, now there, I was getting paid a lot of money to be a circuit court judge. And Bob pointed out to me that I was spending money I didn't have to buy stuff I didn't want or need to impress people I didn't like. And when you spend more money than you're making, Jack, you got financial problems, okay? Feeling of uselessness, full of fear. Oh, no, not me. I've been a cop, a state senator, a circuit court judge. I'm not afraid of anything. How about commitment? How about fear of failure? How about fear of success? How about fear of being found out? You want to try something interesting, go back to your home group next week and walk up behind just about anybody and whisper in their ear, "They know," and walk away. Okay, I'm full of fear. Unhappy, couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. And our book says we have a basic solution to these things right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And those nine bedevilments I've come to know as life. That's what life is. These things present themselves to me on a daily basis. And before, I had no solution for those things. Today, I have a solution for those things. I've had so many wonderful things happen to me since I became an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in Akron for Founders Day. And if you've never been there, go sometime. Go, because it's a great, great weekend. But I got the package where you stay at the college dormitory. And so when you're in the dormitory, you got to go down to the bathroom really early in the morning before it gets trashed. And I was in there minding my own business, and a guy comes in, the second guy in, and, you know, he's real jovial. He said, "Hi, I'm Woody from Baltimore." And I said, "Well, hi, I'm Jack from Hagerstown." He said, "Oh, I go up to Hagerstown all the time." I said, "Woody, what do you do?" I mean, I figure he's a truck driver. He said, "Oh, me and my sponsor, we bring a meeting up to Hagerstown once a month." And I said, "Woody, I am embarrassed to talk to you." He said, "Why is that?" And I said, "Because you're coming 150 miles round trip to bring an AA meeting to a prison. I live 10 miles from that prison. I don't know a single person that goes to that prison with a meeting. Would you like to go with us?" "Woody, I'd really like to talk to you about that, but I got to get back here. And I'll talk to you later about that." So I went back to my room and I told my guy Glenn that I was traveling with. He said, "Did you give him your phone number?" I said, "No." He said, "He'll never find you. There's 15,000 people here." I took some relief from that, felt encouraged. Now, if you've been out to Akron and the food deal, they feed you in this huge dining hall. And you have to sit every seat, fill up every seat down this side of the table. And when they've got it filled up to their satisfaction, they send people down the other side. And so Glenn and I are sitting there, you know, and our side is filling up. Nope, now they're coming down the other side. I wonder who's going to sit in front of me. "Woody. That's the guy. That's him right there." Now, believe me, as a circuit court judge, the last thing I want to do is take meetings into prisons. Trust me on that. Now, I should tell you that I got retired because of the injuries I received. So I got a medical disability. So I was still no longer a circuit court judge. But I had a bunch of people down there in those prisons who had a personal relationship with me. So going to prisons is not my idea. But it seemed that God wanted me to go to prisons. And so I started going to prisons. And it's been really interesting, to say the least. First meeting I attended was chaired by a guy I put in prison. He seemed to have gotten over it. I know sometimes it gets pretty cold up here in Rhode Island, and it gets pretty cold in Maryland. And on a really, 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 really cold day, I saw an ad in a legal newspaper that said, "Be a lawyer in paradise." And it said that the Republic of Palau was looking for assistance attorneys general. It's a tropical paradise, it said. So I fired off a resume, and I went home, and my wife said, "Anything interesting happened at work?" And I should tell you, my wife and I reconciled a year after I got blown up. And I don't recommend getting blown up as a learning experience, by the way. But I told her I'd applied for a job in the Republic of Palau, and she said, "Where's that?" And I said, "I don't know where it is, but it's got to be warmer than it is here." And in point of fact, it's 2 hours southwest of Guam by jet, just 7 degrees above the equator. And to make a long story short, instead of becoming the Assistant Attorney General of the Republic of Palau, I ultimately became the Attorney General of the Republic of Palau. This is a country, ladies and gentlemen. They have a seat in the United Nations. And you may ask yourself, how does an alcoholic retired judge from Western Maryland become the Attorney General of a country? In my case, I answered a newspaper ad. So here I am. I'm attending 6, 7, 8 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week, and I'm going, I got to call General Services, find out they got meetings in Palau. So I call up New York, and they tell me, no, we got meetings in Guam, but not in Palau. And it's 2 hours by jet, and that's pressing going to any lengths, I think. So I signed up for loners, and they said, we'll send you a starter kit. Everything you need to start a meeting in a small town or a small country. So I went to Palau. And my wife had to stay behind till her contract teaching school was up, and then she was coming out. But I hadn't been there 72 hours, and I became aware of a guy who was a photographer from Annapolis, Maryland. And they said, you ought to meet this guy. And I said, well, that'd be good. I said, I saw some of his photos. And I said, is this all he does? And they said, no. He does something up at the hospital with alcohol and drug treatment, but we don't know what that is. Well, so I called first, my very first phone call as Attorney General of this country was to Bill Periclear. And I asked him, are you a friend of Bill W.'s? And he said, well, yes, I am. I said, are there meetings here in Palau? He said, yes, they are. I said, you did not tell New York. He said, I didn't know I had to tell New York. I said, when do you meet? He says, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays up at the National Hospital, 7:30 tonight. Why don't you come? I said, I'll be there. Now, I think, you know, if you're like me and you're going to a new meeting, whether it's in a new town or a new country, you want to dress right. And this is a tropical climate. So I get out all of my AA T-shirts because I want to select just the right one to make the right impression. Now, I'm looking over my array of T-shirts, and I got a bunch of them, and it's clear to me. I got a black T-shirt that says First Things First on it. Now, you don't wear black T-shirts in a tropical climate. But it was saying, wear me. So I put it on. And I went up to the National Hospital, and I found the AA meeting. There were 3 Americans there and 4 Palauans, and they welcomed me to the First Things First group of Karor Palau. I love a good God shot. I love a good God shot. Here's a pamphlet called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's one of the greatest pieces of literature that our fellowship possesses outside of the big book. If you don't have one, I suggest you get one. I suggest you get a bunch of them, give them to your sponsees. I want to read something to you at the very end of the book. Tomorrow, in the churches of many of us, there will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod. And, hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent 2 of his disciples to say to him, Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit. Those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst. And that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. A number of years ago, 2 men, Ken and Bob, working singularly and together, maneuvered me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Today, if they were present and were to ask me, "What did you find, Jack?" I would say to them what I say to you now. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. My name is Jack. I am an alcoholic. Thank you for letting me share it.